The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretic's Hour. Once again, my sound level is kind of low. It's starting out very low, but it'll pick up. So I'll just say again, welcome to The Heretic's Hour on this Monday, June 24th, 2013. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I want to talk about the ethnic state tonight. Before I start, I want to announce that I will not have a live program this coming Saturday. I'm going to take that day off, and we'll probably ask Tan to just leave last Saturday's show to run again, the one with Kevin MacDonald in the second hour, probably. So I'll try to repeat that at the beginning of the second hour. I have it written down, so I should remember it, for those who aren't tuned in yet. But it's been the subject of some debate on my program comment section since I did the June 10th Heretics Hour program titled, Is There Such a Thing as White European Nationalism? And also this past Saturday's program, the one I just mentioned, in which I noted the success of the Golden Dawn and Jobbik parties as purely ethno-nationalist thinking political movements. Another party that I didn't bring up on Saturday, it wouldn't have had time for it, but a listener did write about it, and that is the Ukraine Svoboda Party, which is doing very well also and is very similar to these other two. So that makes three parties over there that are standing up very bravely and having success with it. So replying to some of the comments that were written has forced me to clarify and refine my own thinking, which is very good, about the constant calls for European unity and white unity and how that expresses itself in the political sphere. In other words, does that kind of program transfer into political success? I was going to have a little aside here that, I find myself sometimes feeling, when I hear people saying, oh, we don't want to, bring up this or that, and let's not be divisive. We all need to be united behind this and that, behind everything, I guess. I find myself, excuse me, being a little irritated by that, and I don't always know why. I mean, I haven't thought it all through until now. So that's what I'm going to be giving you tonight is my thinking through so far, along with some other interesting things. So replying, I think that the most serious problem whites everywhere have is our lowering demographics, along with the swift rise in the demographics of those non-whites invading our nation. So it's not only that these people are coming into our nations, but they also have high birth rates, and we have low birth rates. So the total turnaround is going along very rapidly, and in fact, we're at a very poor level at this point where we should have been doing things about it long before now. But people have always said, when things get back bad enough, then the whites will stand up together and do something. Well, see, I never did think that was a good idea. I don't think you ever heard me say that unless I was repeating what someone else said. But because by the time things get bad enough, we don't have the numbers to do anything. I've said this before. So, it's one thing that we have to face, which we don't face well enough and often enough, is that we don't have children anymore. And the demographics are showing absolutely that we don't have children anymore. We are not replacing our white populations. Therefore, we are replaced by mainly third worlders. And I'm not going to belabor this anymore because this is just background that everyone should be aware of. This is just repeating what I already said. All right, the ethnic state, in my opinion, is the best road for turning this around. probably would not have thought about that if it weren't for the success that first the Golden Dawn Party in Greece is having, which is the one that gets the most attention. But also, I've been really happy about the Jobbik Party in Hungary. Really like what they're doing. And now this party in Ukraine, Svoboda, is not quite as good as those two, but is still doing as better than, I don't mean in the numbers, I mean they don't have a policies quite as good as the other two, but they're certainly good enough and they're doing their best. You know, when there is so much criticism and you have powerful Jewish organizations coming to, you know, breathe down your neck. So I think they're doing very well. So all of this gives me an opportunity to see how this can come back, this ethnic state, and because it is coming back, and the fact that we can't overlook that I keep saying is that they're the most successful of all these nationalist political parties, more successful than the ones that are. They're nationalists, but they're a little bit more liberal-minded, or they a little more Jew-friendly, maybe, or they don't want to bring up this or that. They're more careful, and they don't do as well because they're being careful in order to reach all those people that they think they need to reach, that they call more moderate people, which doesn't ever seem to work. So just want to say that the advantages of an ethnic state over a democratic state are clear for us. You can keep Jews out. That's the biggest benefit. I mean, and we need to be forthright about this, you know, and be able to say that we don't want all these Jews in our countries. We don't want these Jews with so much power. Certainly here in the United States, we talked about that on Saturday, but the power of the Jews is just incredible. Been talking about this, and so have others, for a long time. You know, it's time to say that this is something that we cannot tolerate. We should not tolerate. So, but in these other countries, they're not run like the U.S. is. But even there, you know, they don't want Jews telling them what they can do and what they can't do. So. You can pass laws in an ethnic state, such as if you have the majority of the people, you know, who have agreed that say in Hungary that you want only Hungarians of Hungarian blood to hold high office and to represent the people in parliament, things like that, you know, that you don't want non-Hungarians, non-genetic Hungarians. To be in any kind of ruling positions or important positions. And I think, you know, that is legitimate. At least that's what these people are saying. And the second thing you keeping the Jews out. Second, and other undesirables out, other undesirables that you don't want, is that Israel is an ethnic state. And it's an ethno-nationalist state. Now, why is it? You know, why is it that Jews can have their own state and also a right to every privilege available in other states, too? We could not go to Israel and have rights there and have privileges. Probably couldn't get in, although they'll say, well, these Jews have already been in these countries. They are really not Jews. They're Hungarian Jews or Jewish Hungarians or something. And so that's why they have a right to be there. Well, that can be argued and should be argued and needs to be argued. Because they created Israel the way they did because they said Jews weren't welcome anywhere and they needed to have a place to go. So all this needs to come up. Now I want to go straight right now at this point to an article, about Geert Wilders in, the Netherlands. And he's been a controversial figure as far as just how good his program for getting for the Netherlands is. You know, the Netherlands is a very liberal nation, has always been, and he probably represents that fairly well. And people say, you know, he hasn't been wanting to antagonize the Jews at all. He's going after the Muslims, which he sees as a very big problem there, which it is. But I just want to read this because this is in the JNS. It was June 10th, so it's a couple of weeks ago. Probably some Jewish news service or something. But it says that, according to him, okay, a quote from him, that Europeans need to follow the example of the Jewish people and reestablish their nation state to counter the growing Islamization of their countries. That's what he said Sunday in Los Angeles, June 10th, or around then. And he said, "My friends, what we need today is Zionism for the nations of Europe." And then says he's the founder and leader of the Party for Freedom in the Netherlands. And he said at this conference, Europe's Last Stand, conference, which is organized by the American Freedom Alliance, he described that Europe's inner cities, have come to resemble Northern Africa and the Middle East because they are ruled by Islamic Sharia law, noting that Islamic areas border the European Union headquarters in Brussels, and that largely Islamic suburbs surround Paris. He says, Europe is in a terrible state. Bit by bit, European countries are losing their national sovereignty. And then it's just, that's it. Then it's just some comments by some Jew from the Ayn Rand Institute in Irvine, California. But, you know, I'd have to say that this is pretty good. These are pretty good comments by him. I would have to say that this is not a bad way of talking, and I think we should point out that if the Jews can have Zionism, that we should all be able to have our own form of Zionism and a right to our own nation to do as we wish without anybody else having a say in it. So it bothers me when those who are in the fight for the white cause put down talk of ethnic loyalty as divisive and as squabbling, as let's not emphasize the ethnicities, let's emphasize only our unity, our pan-Europeanism and so on. And they want to assert, also, some of these same people want to assert their Christian-hating paganism or atheism as though that has any popularity at all in the larger mass of the population. So I don't see that they have a very good argument here, and I can't, but I'll just say here on this program, though, that it's the non-ethnic combination or consolidated national alliances that are opposed to strong ethnic identity and are forming us into globalized citizens who see the whole world as our stage and all men as brothers under the skin. Now, that might be going a little far, but what I'm trying to say is that when we try to put forth that all Europeans are alike in the name of unity and solidarity, etc., and these people will always say, oh, no, we just have to have this European racial solidarity, but then everybody can have their own, their own nation, their own cultural traditions and so on. Yeah, that's exactly the way the European Union always talk. That's exactly the way all of these organizations that want to merge people together in some larger, much larger unit, they all talk that way. They all say everything is going to be preserved, but it never is preserved. And so I'm just trying, I think, as I look at this, that the more we get used to consolidating ourselves into alliances, the less sensitive we are maybe to our diversity and our distinctiveness, and the more ready we are to let it go and see ourselves as not so distinct as we would can be in ethno-nationalist states. Now, I know that there are people who who have a different view of this and who would argue differently, but I'll just continue on here because this is my time to say what I think. Examples of strong movements toward the ethnic state today, as I've already mentioned, are found in Greece, Hungary, and the Svoboda Party in Ukraine. I say these are strong movements because others seem to be more timid about it than these parties. And as I already said before, they're not as successful. So, and it's my belief that the NPD, National Democratic Party, or National Party of Germany, however you want to call it, is of Deutschland, is as uncompromising in its principles as Golden Dawn and Jobbik, but they are under extreme persecution and are fighting simply for the right to remain a political party there in Germany. So they're not saying very much, and they can't say very much. But they do. I do read that they have meetings with these two groups, and that's good. So that, you know, they're on the same page. But they just are having, you know, they have a much harder time operating in Germany today than these other parties do in their nations. And I'm sure that there are other strong parties, but they just are not having the electoral success that these are. Even those who have been around longer. And so I don't know, if these parties will continue to have the success that they're having now. I mean, if it will continue to rise, or if they've reached a high point. I mean, you know, you never know. But I will just say that tonight, although I talked about these Golden Dawn and Jobbik in the first hour of Saturday's show, tonight I want to extol the benefits of the ethnic state for we white people right now. No one would deny that the ultimate ethnic state of the past is National Socialist Germany. But there are a lot of people today who want to revise history and twist the meaning of things to claim that the Führer Adolf Hitler changed his thinking on race and ethnic purity as time went on from what he wrote in Mein Kampf. They point to his relations with Arab leaders, the forming of some African units of the Wehrmacht, along with the divisions of non-Germans in the Waffen-SS, and so on. I didn't get a chance to write more on this little topic here. I need to say more about it. There was a big change that took place when the war broke out, when Germany was at war and needed to have allies and work with people that they weren't, that were not quite as important to them previously. And since there were so many of their fellow white nations and white people fighting against them as abject enemies, they turned to who they could for alliances and allies. Which was not, I'm not saying it was an insincere or a cynical effort, but, you know, this is what you do. And so some things took place once the war started that probably would not have if there hadn't been any war. But, of course, at the same time, there never was any animosity amongst the National Socialist regime toward any of these other nations, even, you know, that were different racially. They wanted to get along diplomatically and work with every other nation in the world in one way or another. But it so happened that, when so many white nations turned against them, they did have stronger alliances with some non-white nations. But that doesn't mean that this was a basic change in Adolf Hitler's thinking from what he had always thought about keeping the racial purity of Germans intact. So, I'll go on to say that I think it behooves us to look at the way the German National Socialist State was set up. It was organized. How it was organized? You know, the Golden Dawn and Jobbik and Svoboda Party too. Look at the National Socialist Party of Germany, and they have copied quite a bit of it, copied what parts they can and that they thought would do them the most good. They have admitted this. You can either see that they have, or they have sometimes said that they have, but they have to be careful of saying, or actually saying that, though, you know, because they have to say, no, you know, we're not Nazi, we're not neo-Nazi, we're not this, we're not that. And they are, you know, what they do, they adapt it to their own nation, which is what they should be doing. But it's clear to see that they all three look with admiration to the National Socialist regime of the Third Reich. And so from this, we can get an idea just what kind of an ethnic state National Socialist Germany was or wasn't. I'm going to go into that a little bit here. I think it's will be helpful. But I want to say that I came upon something just before the show that was from 1 month ago, and about the Hungarian Guard in Budapest, and the Hungarian Guard spokesman was being interviewed, talked, you know, by someone. I think this was Channel 4. He told, his name was Joseph, he told the reporter, in answer to whatever his question was, quote, "We have a domestic problem that is the gypsy criminality and an external problem that is the Jew expansion." I'm not real clear why he uses the word the Jew expansion, but of course he was speaking in Hungarian, probably. So this is translated anyway. I understand the first one. But when asked about the past suffering by this reporter of Hungarian Jews, he replied, "If we want to remember victims, in my mind, the Holocaust is not the biggest tragedy. This has nothing to do with me. It doesn't interest me. I don't deny it. I'm just not interested." See, I think they do a pretty good job of answering these questions. They don't pull back. They don't apologize. They don't deny what they, you know, what they believe. But at the same time, they word it, and they're very direct, actually. But they put it in ways that downplaying the Holocaust, which is what should happen with the Holocaust, should be downplayed. And that's very good. I like the way they operate. And so far, they're getting away with it. Now, going to back to the National Socialist regime, I think one thing that was important to comment on here is their education program, because all of these ethnic states, if we start to have them, will have an important part of what they're doing will be their education system. And in Germany in 1934, a man named Bernard Rust was selected as Minister of Science, Education, and National Culture. And he set about to reshape the German educational system to conform to his ideals, or to the ideals of National Socialism. He was kind of an old timer. I mean, he's tried and true. They have given him a reputation as kind of a nutty guy and kind of a crazy guy and a guy who was doing a lot of screwy things, but it seems to me that he did all right. He held his position all the way through. And so he wasn't fired. Hitler had faith in him. He had joined the NSDAP in 1922, and he became a district leader. In 1930, he was elected to the Reichstag. In 1933, after Hitler became chancellor, he was appointed as Prussian Minister for Cultural Affairs. So, you know, obviously he had a long career, and he was dedicated, and basically he did a pretty good job, even though there were those who criticized him. But, okay, I already said that. He reportedly instructed teachers. Now, this is supposed to be one of the criticisms, you know, by our enemies. that he reportedly instructed teachers that their aim was to educate ethnically aware Germans. As though, oh, terrible, educate ethnically aware people, that's some form of racism. But, you know, in an ethnic state, this is necessary. This is what you do in an ethnic state. How are you going to have an ethnic-based state and have people, and not have your, you know, your people ethnically aware of themselves, you know, and the importance of their ethnicity? And in this case, it was German. In other cases, it would be Hungarian, Greek, Ukrainian. For those who think that this is somehow divides people from one another, divides Europeans from one another, I don't see this as a problem. I think you're not going to have people fighting for their country and their nation and keeping foreigners out and so on and wanting to have children and build up their populations and make themselves stronger. You're not going to have that unless they have a lot of pride in their identity and they take it seriously. And you have to deal with whatever kind of little problems that come up from that when you have different nations side by side who care more about their own nation than the other. But everybody is intelligent enough to see that you have to work together for the benefit of your own nation. You have to work with others and try to have peace and so on. So that is really not a problem. The real problem is when the Jews get in there and when there are too many foreigners involved in your country. So that is the real problem, not the fact that people have a nationalistic pride in their own people and their own history. So this Rust also made an interesting comment that the problems of science do not present themselves in the same way to all men. The Negro or the Jew will view the same world in a different light from the German investigator. So here he's going to race, but he is pointing out that, you know, different races don't see the world in the same way. And he's just using the German here because he's German. But you'd use any, whatever, you know, nationality you were, you'd fit that in there. But I see... and here they've classed the Negro with the Jew, or he has in National Socialist thinking. And I just say that the idea that Negroes were liked or accepted by National Socialism is false. There was no desire to harm them, as I think I already pointed out, just as the Jew was not harmed. There was no desire to harm these people, but they did not belong in German society. That was the idea. Okay, and so this Rust also was instrumental in purging German universities of Jews and other enemies of the state. They were considered enemies of the state, most notably the University of Göttingen, one of the world's great universities in Saxony. But here are some of the people who were expelled or fled: Einstein, Max Born, Victor Goldschmidt, James Franck, Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, Edward Teller, you know, that one of the geniuses who built the atomic bomb for the United States. Emmy Noether and Richard Courant were expelled, or they fled. Most of them just fled. But see, in an ethnic state, Jews don't belong. But in a democratic state, everyone belongs. And that's the problem with our belief that democracy is so great. With democracy comes tolerance of everyone, and where you have people can become citizens no matter where they were born or what race or ethnicity they come from, and that is a totally different being than an ethnic state. Now, teachers, another point here is that in their schooling, teachers were directed to instruct their pupils in the nature, causes, and effects of all racial and hereditary problems, to bring home to them the importance of race and heredity for the life and destiny of the German people. So this goes on a little more, but I'll stop here for now. And this is also necessary. If you're going to have a strong ethnic community or a strong nation that is homogeneous, you have got to do this. You've got to teach this to your kids. Everybody teaches their beliefs to their children in their schools. Every nation, every kind of people, every type of government, everybody does it. But they try to make out that when Germany did it, that it was terrible because they taught about race and heredity in the schools to the kids. And it went on to say that you need to awaken in the children a sense of their responsibility toward the community of the nation, their ancestors, the present generation, and posterity, pride in their membership in the German race as the foremost vehicle of hereditary Nordic values, and the will consciously to cooperate in the racial purification of the German stock. Now, I'm going to get into pan-Europeanism, but if you had, instead of this, everything was taught as European, our pride in the membership of the European white race and the values and so on, you'd run into problems, I think, and it would not have the same effect as talking about your particular national group. That's where the power is. That's where the emotional recognition is, the emotional the emotional power is in this. It doesn't do any good. It weakens. The further out you go from the tightest group that you have, the weaker and weaker this bonding becomes. So, and of course, this instruction was to begin with the youngest pupils. Sure, you start 6 years of age. Everybody does that. Says that the Führer desired that no boy or girl should leave school without complete knowledge, of the necessity and meaning of blood purity. So this was the program of National Socialist Germany, which was, this pure program was probably not quite as effective, I mean, not carried out in quite the same way. Once the war started, because the war became such a huge thing that it just blotted out everything, and everything went toward that effort, and these other things were probably ignored a little bit. Let go. I mean, there wasn't as much concern about it, but. Also in world history was to be portrayed as a history of racially determined people. The racial idea leads to the rejection of democracy. This is what Bernard Rust said. He says, the racial idea leads, or at least this is what the program says, the racial idea leads to the rejection of democracy and other equalizing tendencies, specified as pan-Europa or international civilization, and strengthens understanding for the leadership idea. So all this came, this was from an order of the Minister of Education, Dr. Bernard Rust, for all German schools, and it was from 1935. So, the policy was that they were not for pan-Europeanism at that time. They were not for pan-Europa any more than for international civilization. And that the racial idea was at that time German race. It was, the German race. And other people would see it as their race, but the Germans had a very clear idea of what their race was. It wasn't just white race. It was something more specific than that. Not that they didn't recognize themselves as part of the white race. But I just want to say here that we have now people calling for Europa unity, they are actually using a form of democracy among Europeans with parliaments, congresses, elections, and so on. I'll get into that very shortly here. So let's see. There was a book that was given to graduating students, that is, students graduating from the eighth grade in 1940, that described all the things that, a lot of things that were expected of them. And one thing it talked about was the Germans who had to immigrate in groups and settled in foreign realms. They were considered to be lost to the German ethnic body once that happened. Although it says they some of them, and this was among my people, who went to some of these areas, they kept their ethnicity pure against a foreign environment without the help or thanks of Germans in the homeland. Well, that's my people did that, and a lot of them did, but some just became less and less German. So that's just, I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to skip some stuff here. So how did we get to put a little better face on this getting away from the ethnic idea than I've done so far? There's an idea of a United States of Europe that's been around for a long time. George Washington wrote to, going all the way back to George Washington, who was, you know, the founder of the United States of America. So he thought the United States of America was just the perfect thing. He was very proud of it. He thought they had created something fantastic and new and progressive there. And so he wrote to the Marquis de Lafayette, and he said, quote, "One day, on the model of the United States of America, a United States of Europe will come into being." So that's how old this this idea is. And it goes also, can be Victor Hugo, who was a French writer, poet, and very famous person and influential in his time in the 1800s. Let's see, he was born in 1802 and died in 1885. And he talked about the United States of Europe in a speech at the International Peace Conference. It's always these kind of things, you see, where this goes on. International Peace Conference, Congress, held in Paris in 1849. He favored the creation of a supreme sovereign senate, which will be to Europe what Parliament is to England. That was his first idea. And he said, a day will come when all nations on our continent will form a European brotherhood. A day will come when we shall see the United States of America and the United States of Europe face to face, reaching out for each other across the seas. Well, I think that he was French, and all this talk that was going on about United States of Europe was very popular in France. And France, of course, thought that they would be the dominant party in all of that. And so they were all for it, just like they thought they would be the dominant party in the European Union, too. Although right now they're kind of falling by the wayside out of their own failures. But I will see. Victor Hugo also planted a tree at his residence on the island of Guernsey, and he said that had this famous saying that when this tree matured, the United States of Europe would have come into being. Well, the tree is still there, they said, we have something like that now. But he was he was considered a French romantic. Now, so in 1867, following along, Giuseppe Garibaldi an Italian, and John Stuart Mill, an Englishman, joined Victor Hugo at a Congress of the League for Peace and Freedom in Geneva. So here, an interesting sidelight here is that the anarchist, Russian anarchist, Mikhail Bakunin, who is a very well-known anarchist and even well-known in amongst European followers, stated that, quote, in order to achieve the triumph of liberty, justice, and peace in the international relations of Europe and to render civil war impossible among the various peoples which make up the European family, only a single course lies open: to constitute the United States of Europe. Now, why this anarchist was, I guess he kind of changed his tune as time went on, but why he was pushing for a United States of Europe, I don't know. But he was, and this was very, just such a popular idea. You know how these ideas become so popular. And it was all about, we're going to have world peace, we're going to have these international get-togethers, and we're all going to agree on things, and, you know, we're going to turn the, we're going to create wonderful programs of social programs and so on in the world, and this is the way to do it. Now, the French National Assembly, in March 1871, just 4 years later, called for a United States of Europe, too. And once again, I say France clearly intended to rule over such a united body. But now we move on to First World War and following. Well, let me just say that after all of this talk about these programs that were going to bring peace and prosperity and good things and so on, then somehow the First World War happened. Of course, in my opinion, it was brought about basically by the shenanigans of the Jews, but the international Jews and other Jews. But that's, we won't go into that now, but anyway, that happened anyway, the First World War. A shockingly horrible war that nobody expected. And in 1923, the Austrian Count Richard Kuttenhof Kalergi founded the Pan-Europa movement and hosted the first Pan-European Congress held in Vienna in 1926. People are familiar with this Kuttenhof Kalergi, he has a pretty bad reputation. But anyway, this is what he was promoting, was Pan-Europa movement, and he had this Congress, and the aim was for a Europe based on the principles of liberalism, Christianity, and social responsibility. The liberalism I get, the Christianity was probably to simply fit in, you know, with the religion of something that was European. And the social responsibility was to have plenty of social programs, which is okay if you're going to be all European. But therefore, we know that was all these things have a certain amount of attention and appeal for a while, but that didn't go anywhere. And so after the communist revolution in Russia, at about the same time, here, Trotsky also called for a Soviet United States of Europe under communist rule. So he liked the United States of Europe idea, but he wanted it to be Soviet. And in 1929, now we're getting into where National Socialism is quite well known in Germany, and it's a fact, political factor, serious political factor at this time. And now the French Prime Minister, Aristide Briand, gave a speech before the Assembly of the League of Nations. We're at the League of Nations now, in which he proposed the idea of a federation of European nations based on solidarity and in the pursuit of economic prosperity and political and social cooperation. You know, and now, listen to this. The French Prime Minister in 1929, he's promoting economic prosperity and political and social cooperation for Europe through some kind of, through the, you know, a federation of European nations. And what gall, I say, because at this time, Germany was still struggling under the Treaty of Versailles. It was complaining about it, and many others thought that this, some of these things should be lifted from Germany. It was too strict. It was not, you know, was not part of the progressive ideas of the time. But it was the French who would not do that. It was the French who wanted to keep Germany in as bad a position as possible. And this French Prime Minister is, you know, talking like this. It's just all so, so hypocritical. And then, of course, it became economic. Many economists like John Maynard Keynes supported this idea of a federation of European nations and so on for economic reasons. And at the League of Nations request, this Prime Minister Briand presented a memorandum on the organization of a system of European Federal Union. He did this in 1930. And in 1931, French politician Edouard Herriot and British civil servant Arthur Salter both wrote books titled The United States of Europe. So, you know, this was just going on and on and on about the United States of Europe. And the term was also used by Winston Churchill. He got in the act after World War II. Now, we, in, you know, here we have, this is stuff is being talked about. I don't know. We jumped from 1931 all the way to 1946, all that was going on during that time. But now Germany's National Socialism is defeated, and now they're back on the world stage again with their talk like this. And Winston Churchill, delivered a speech in 1946 in Switzerland, and he said, we must build a kind of United States of Europe. In this way only will hundreds of millions of toilers be able to regain the simple joys and hopes which make life worth living. Hundreds of millions of toilers. I don't know who he was speaking of. The European people who were suffering from the effects of the war, or other people. But this is what he said. However, in the final paragraphs of this speech, it's clear that Churchill envisioned a United States of Europe without the participation of Britain. He said that the British Commonwealth which still existed, would coexist with other powers such as mighty America and, I trust, Soviet Russia. So he put Britain with mighty America and the Soviets, and didn't want to take part in the United States of Europe, but he thought that there should be one. And he was still, you know, sticking his nose in their business. He took the unionist position to European integration, which was one approach, and the other was the federalist position, the unionist position and the federalist position. The Federalists advocated full integration with the Constitution, which is what most of the European nations wanted, it says, while the Unionist people advocated a consultative body. But the Federalists prevailed at the Congress of Europe. And the primary accomplishment of this Congress of Europe after World War II was the European Court of Human Rights, which still exists on its own, apart from the European Union, and predates the European Union. And as you know, eventually the European Union was pushed along, and so we have the whole history of that now. And the European Union moved from being an economic partnership to strengthen the import exports and so on of the country, and so they wouldn't be I guess, competing against one another and all various sort of things. And this went along with all kinds of other trade treaties that for the United States and Britain and other all kinds of other peoples that were going on at that time, taking away from the sovereignty of individual nations by signing into these treaties. And then the European Union went on to be more political, and then finally we get they want it to be monetary, and we get the euro. The idea of the euro was pushed for a long time until that came into being, and nations gave up their own coinage. Of course, the Germans gave up the most when they gave up the Deutschmark, which was the strongest currency in Europe, and put all their backing for strength to back the euro, and are still being asked to contribute greatly to that cause. And that's in trouble. So it's all in trouble now, thank goodness. And this is what happens, in my opinion, to these grand plans of unifying large numbers of individual peoples who have had a history of their own and are now going to join together in such a create something grander, and it's going to bring peace and prosperity and good justice and all these good words, you know, to us all. And they never pan out that way. They never pan out that way. But the a modern example of this is Norman Lowell's Imperium Europa. And if you're familiar with that, he started this. He founded this in 2000, the year 2000. He's from the island of Malta, little tiny island, but it is part of Europe. And it's called a far right political party, and he is designated as being a part of the new right. And whenever I hear the new right, I don't care for it. You know, I don't like the new right. I don't like the term. I don't know. You know, it doesn't mean anything. It's another one of these ideas that make people think there's something better here than what we had before. But if you examine it, it's not. Anyway, Norman Lowell says that the primary aim of this party of his, which actually translates to the Empire of Europe, Imperium Europa is Latin, and it in English it's the Empire of Europe. And he wants to unite Europe into one political entity. Well, that's what it says on that it's a political entity. The stated goal of the party is to unite all European natives under one flag, hence the name Imperium Europa, Empire Europe, leading to a European or a European bond forged through spirituality, closely followed by race. So it's a spiritual bond to this Norman Lowell first, because he thinks that Europeans, true Europeans, have what they share is something spiritual, even more than race. Now, I'm not sure, excuse me, how he thinks of those words, but I don't have any faith in him either. Anyway, he goes on to say this bond is nurtured through high culture, protected by high politics, enforced by the elite. So it's very much elitist, and that Europeans are already the elite members of the world. And they're going to organize, and the elite of the elite are going to run it. And, of course, he is one. He is one of these elite. He is the most elite of all because he founded it. And he was making a big effort when he started this. And even back in 2010, I know that he was pushing this a lot, writing to people and appearing on shows and stuff. And I didn't, well, I you know how I don't like much, so I didn't like it. But a lot of people did. A lot of our people did, and there was a lot of positive feeling about it. That, and there is today, what I want to get across here before we go to the break is that there is a lot of feeling that Europeans need to unite as Europeans in some way in order to give us strength, you know, strength through unity, solidarity, and make us, if we work together, we could overcome our enemies if we only worked together. But what I find fault with there, with that approach, is that you're only going to have still the Europeans who think like we do, the racially minded Europeans, and working together, you know, you're not going to get all these others to work together with you. They're going to working together with our enemies. So this doesn't seem to me to lead us anywhere. And we've been going around and around with this idea, pan-Europeanism and so on, for quite a while. And it doesn't lead anywhere. And the parties don't do well. And there's no success. I don't see any success. I do see success with these, what I'm calling ethnic parties and the idea of having an ethnic-based state. And so I will go on with, that's about it for that. I'm going to go into the Napola Institutes in Germany in the second half. But if there's any, if anybody wants to call in and question any of this or has something they really want to say, you can call after we get back, after I get back from the break at 830-443-4911. And so stay with me for a very interesting second half to this program.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is the Heretics Hour on June 24th, 2013. I want to say again that I won't be having a live show on Saturday, this coming Saturday, June 29th. I'm going to take that day off. I have a lot of things going on around that time. And so don't be prepared for a rerun on that time and day. So but I was talking, I still need to say a few things about the ethnic state. And, you know, of course, I've been speaking about Europe. I'm not a European. I'm an American. It's easier, though, to talk about Europe when we talk about these things, because there they are with their nations still hanging on there with those nations. And they seem to be making a comeback, the ethnic concern, the ethnic loyalty to these nations is under, after all this United States of Europe stuff, it seems to be starting to make a comeback, which I'm very happy to see. But that, you know, I still have to deal as an American with our problems here in America, and they're very different and not as easy. but I would just say that I think that we need to see ourselves, we need to kind of turn being a white American into some kind of an ethnic group. It's not really, it isn't one, but, you know, we need to kind of see it that way in order to see ourselves as some group that has, all this in common, and we have common problems and a common future, or not a lack of a future, that we are facing, and we need to work together as white Americans. I don't see any other way to put us. I don't see a way to actually, even though there are a lot of people very aware of their ethnicity in the United States, and that should be encouraged, I think, because I just like to sum up the first hour by saying that I think there is nothing more. I mean, the closer you get to the number of you, the closer that you get to the more individualist, or not individual, that's not the right word either, to the most core part of your being is better. And you know, the race is one thing. It's a larger number. The smaller number is actually like a family or tribe, and our nationality is an expression of that, just all those people who are part of that larger, you know, family tribe. And that is where your deepest identity is going to be found, I think, when it comes to wanting to preserve and save that which reflects you, yourself, and what you are. So I think that the more that we can bring back ethnicity and not think about it as being something that divides us, but being something that each group can take pleasure in or pride in or whatever, however they see it. The better it is for us. But at the same time, we don't have those nations here. We are one thing. We are Americans, and it's a difficult problem for us because of the way our country is so totally multicultural in ways that it's hard to change. You know, it's easier to change it in European countries still today than it's not easy at all to change it here. So we have to do a lot of thinking, and I think a lot of Americans want to talk about Europe. I know I talk about Europe a lot. I know I've done it tonight, and I've done it on other programs because, yeah, it's easier. But it's a way they don't want to talk about here in the United States because they don't have any solutions, and it's easier to think what the Europeans should do. But we're not Europeans, those of us who are Americans. And so I think that we need to start. I think that this does need to be looked at and discussed. And the more it's discussed, the clearer people's ideas get, because there's a lot of hazy, confused ideas out there. And I probably sounded very hazy and confused myself tonight, but I think I have some clear ideas. It's just been hard for me to express them very well. They are there, and much more well defined than they were even 2-3 weeks ago. So there you are. This is something that should be talked about, I think. I'm going to talk about the Napola schools in Germany, which fits in, here I'm going back to Europe again, but fits into what I was actually discussing in the first hour. But it also fits something that I'm going to be posting on my website, carolynyager.net. I hope to get it up tomorrow. I thought I might get it up today, but other things came up and I wouldn't have been able to. So I will hope to get it up tomorrow. But, you know, I've been posting things about the Wenger family, both Willy Wenger, who's living now in Austria, and his brother Leopold Wenger, who died in 1945 in air battle over Vienna at the very end of the war. But he has he was a student at Napola, and I've been getting a lot of material, both his now these letters that he wrote from Napola. He was at the Napola in Koslin, which is the third one that was founded of the 40 or so that existed by the end of the war. But there was the one he went to was number 3 of, you know, in terms of when it originated. And Koslin is way up close to the Baltic Sea in northern, actually it was what is now Poland. I don't know what it was called then. I can look here at this page. It was in Pomerania, yeah, which is today Poland. The German name of the city is Koslin. It's something else now in Polish, but he wrote letters home during 1939, and I have some of them translated. I'm going to be posting them along with some pictures. I don't have all of them translated yet. I hoped that I would, but I don't. So these letters go I'm trying to think of what I should say first here to put this. These letters show they're not full of excitement or anything. They just show what this school was like and how it was for the students and for him. And just the normal, you know, it's a wonderful record, because if you look up Napola schools on the internet, you don't find much at all. And what you do find is all propaganda, for the most part, by our enemies. And I'm going to go into some of that in very shortly. But so this, I think, is so valuable just from that point of view of showing exactly how it was for this particular young Austrian, who was now a German, you know, a Reich citizen, because Austria was added to the Reich in 1938. And he was 16 and a half years old when he entered that school. And he, and that's pretty young, but that's about right for, it was like, they were like military boarding schools. But you don't find anything very accurate written about them, and so this shows this is a picture of the history of the time, and it's very valuable to those who are wanting to set up their own ethnic states in their own school systems and see you know what know more about what these particular ones were like, and I will describe more about it in a minute, but what I wanted to say, yeah, about my website. So I have these letters, and someone was translating them for me, and he translated 2 months' worth. I've got from the first one is April 20th, and then goes to what I've got goes to around June 18th, so 2 months. But they go all the way to November. And he got bored with them. He found them boring. He said, and this is Wilf Hank. He's got other work he wants to do. I don't find him boring. But he did. So, he didn't get very far with it. But, so I'm looking for a translator. That's what I'm trying to get at here. I had a few translators and I'm not getting the material back now at all. So I'm seeking out here on the program tonight. I know there are a lot of people out there who are listeners of this program and followers of the White Network and my website who know German and know English. You have to be pretty fluent in both languages to translate, although the English translation doesn't have to be perfect. I'm able to edit, you know, mistakes and typos and misspellings and various things like that. But generally, I don't think this is hard to translate. This is not like intellectual material. This is just day-to-day, you know, like you write in a letter home what you're doing and so on. So I don't think it's real difficult. So I'm asking for people to contact me, if you're willing, to do this translation. Probably easier for native German speakers who are good at English than it would be for a native English speaker who's good at German. But whatever, I'm looking for some translators. And in addition to these letters from Napola, I have all these letters from and reports, the log reports and so on, of Leopold's flights. He was a Luftwaffe fighter pilot, and he became a Jag fighter, the bomber, where they added bomb capability to these fighter planes, and so he's both a fighter and a bomber both, but light, you know, a lightweight, small. He had a tour of duty, long one, over with Britain in the 1940s, after he got out of that school, and then he had a stint in Sicily, and then he had a stint in the on the Eastern Front. So I have all that to be done, and I'm waiting for people to get it translated. So please contact me if you feel like you can do that and are willing to do it at Carolyn@CarolynJaeger.net. So now. The reason that this fits in too, for other reasons, with the idea of the ethnic state, is that education is a very important part of that state, and of course these Napola schools, it stands for National Political Institutes of Education, and were known as NPEA for short, because of the German words have an E and an A. They were like secondary boarding schools, and they were started in 1933, as soon as Hitler came into power, and continued to 1944, actually 1945, but there weren't any new ones brought on board after 1944. And they were basically under the Reich Department of Education. They were state run, but the SS had a role in it, and from 1939 they came more under the direct influence of the SS. That's because of, again, the war. You know, the war changes things. Now, I'll tell you that Leopold Wenger and his best friend, Gilbert Giesendorfer, were both 16. Well, Leopold was 16, and they saw an ad. They were both had rank, certain rank in the Hitler Youth already. Leopold had been in the Hitler Youth for quite a while, and had a some kind of commander position, not the highest, but and he was just good at everything he did. And they saw this ad in their local newspaper for calling on young men to apply to go to this school up there, told something about it, and so they decided that they wanted to try that. And they would go up there. This is what these kids, you know, I guess his parents just said, okay. I mean, you know, he pretty much did what he wanted. He was a very responsible young man. And they decided they would go up there and apply. And if they didn't make it, well, then they would at least go and see, you know, see Berlin, see the Reich, and see some sights and come back home again. They weren't worried about it. And so they planned their trip and they went. And they were both accepted after extensive testing and rather grueling testing. And he talks about that some. And he was allowed into the eighth grade level, which was a grade higher than he actually was in regular school, because he did so well on all the tests. And so he talks about all that. And this is, when I get that up, you know, you'll be able to read as far as we have to go, and hopefully we'll have the rest of it translated fairly soon. And I have a lot of pictures too. And it's just, it's very interesting. Now, these schools were based on, cadet institutes that were always in Imperial Germany, cadet institutes, and there was nothing unusual or different about them, but they were under the National Socialist regime, and they were highly selective. Only about 20% of applicants were accepted. The criteria included racial origins, physical fitness, and membership of the Hitler Youth. So, you know, you had to have been a member of the Hitler Youth to even be considered. And then they did extensive search and study of your racial origins, and a lot about physical fitness, and then academic ability, which they did right there. You know, Leopold said that it wasn't like what he thought. He thought he would be asked questions or something, but they were like put into a classroom situation, and there was something just like an ordinary class going on. And it turned out that if you participated in the discussion and so on, you did well. And if you didn't, you didn't do well. Anyway, he even mentioned, I forget now, but it's how many were accepted from this large entry group that came to apply. Not very many. I mean, it was 20% or something like that. A lot of people were turned away. So it's pretty demanding, because this was considered to be, they were going to the Reich was going to be educating and producing its leadership, his coming leadership. And the leadership was all, they always were going to need a top grade leadership. And so it'd be continuing, you know, the schools, this kind of school. So this was the most elite school in National Socialist Germany, these Napolis schools. And even not everybody who started out was accepted, finished the program and graduated. These schools are just nothing but criticized by our democratic regimes, you know, as being, I don't know why they criticize them, because they're like any other, elite school, and everybody has their own elite schools, but they don't, you know, still they want to criticize these Nazi elite schools, and that they wanted to train a new generation of German leaders, that they were training future German leaders, as though the Germans didn't have any right to train German leaders, but everybody else has a right to train, you know, new leaders for themselves. It's just the usual kind of unfairness that goes on. They were, of course, single gender for boys, and there was eventually four schools for girls, three for quite a while, but they didn't come until, I think, after the war started, until after 1939, that they form some schools for girls, because then again, the war, you know, they needed everybody. They needed all kinds of better trained people to carry on responsibilities, including women. And they were called Jungmann, or in plural, Jungmannen, young men. That means young men or young man. That was the term given to these students. And this is how they were divided. This is something I got off the internet, actually, but it seems quite accurate. Let's see. They all this a lot of repetition here. They were, but the schools were funded and supported by the Minister of Education, which was national then. They were national schools. They weren't local schools under the local states or the local Gaus or the local anything regional. Areas they were under the Reich government and under the Minister of Education, and so that's about that. Now, looking for information about these schools, as I said, you're going to learn a lot about them, how they actually were, which is just kind of ordinary, from these letters by Poldi Wenger. And he was a good letter writer, you know. He was a good son. He was a firstborn. He is a very responsible boy and young man. And he loved his family. His family loved him. You know, they were a close family. And so he did his duty in every way. And we don't have their letters to him, but that probably wouldn't be, that would probably be a little too much. But we see what kind of a place it was, and he would have been telling the truth in his letters home. He wasn't somebody who had to hide things from his family. He was very much a truth teller anyway, you can tell when you read his things. And he always kept a diary of sorts, or a notebook, or, recorded what he was doing. So, he was just like that. And he did that when he was all through his Luftwaffe career. You know, he kept a report on what was going on. So, but when you look at information about these schools, the Napolis schools, it's just terrible propaganda. And mostly what you find is this movie called Before the Fall, which was made by a German, Dennis Gansel, and it was, it came out, I think it came out maybe around 2005, 2006 or something. I never saw it, but I looked at one segment, the first segment of it on YouTube yesterday, but I didn't watch any more of it because it just turns me off so much I can hardly stand it. The way the whole thing begins and the way they set up the story of this boy, and the way they show the Nazis and the students in this school, some of them, is just horrible. It's total evil propaganda. I mean, nothing like the way it was. But there's this movie review called I found a movie review on the World Socialist website, which is, you know, the Communist Party. They call themselves Socialist Party, but World Socialist whatever. But they this review was totally biased, but it's kind of interesting. I'm going to go through it and show how they distort things. And, you know, when they are the enemy, when your enemy describes you. So you've got the enemy here reviewing this film, which is also made by the enemy. And they praise the film as being so well done and so accurate and so on. Well, this is what you get. What you get is what I'm going to go through here. He writes that the National Political Institutes of Learning, NAPLIS, were established to train the elite of Hitler's thousand-year Reich. A NAPLIS secondary school education was a prototypical grooming for the Nazi political hierarchy. And, this is the part I wanted to read. Creating this elite involved indoctrination to break down mental and physical resistance and produce a core of unscrupulous men and women blindly devoted to the Führer and the new German master race. Now, this is written in all seriousness here on this website, and the author of this review is Joanne Laurier, and it was written on April 20th, the date Hitler's birthday, 2006. It's just a movie review. It says it's directed by Dennis Gansel. It was written by this Gansel and a woman named Maggie Perrin. And this Gansel, I didn't try to look him up. I didn't really have time, but I don't think he's Jewish. I don't care whether he is or not. Whether he's Jewish or not Jewish. He's just a German that hates Nazi hating German. He's supposed to be a German. His name doesn't sound a little German though. I don't know what he is, but his father, he says his father, was in a NAPLIS school, or was it his grandfather? And that's why he got interested in it. So I guess he's German. This woman wrote, you know, and this is the general idea that is passed around and that we have to deal with, and that they will talk like this about every ethnic state that wants to, you know, do something for its own people and keep others out, and be a nation of its own nationality and ethnicity and race and so on. They will write like this about it, but that this school had to break down mental and physical resistance of its students to produce unscrupulous people who would follow the Führer and become the new German master race. Well, you know, it's nothing. Nobody had to be broken down. Nobody had any, you know. Just isn't like that. So it says it's, I'm going to skip some of this stuff. He says that in the NAPLA, the movie is about this boy, is a story about this boy, Friedrich, who is, it takes place in Prague, although amongst Germans in Prague. I don't know why they wanted it to be in Prague, but and this Friedrich is a amateur boxer, and it's some at his gym where he was boxing a match, you know, just not for money or anything, just because he wants to. Some Nazis came in uniform, and they watched him, and this one nasty kid, you know, they made him into a real icky person, really, about as icky as you can get. They're not like that. Nobody was like that. But then this officer watched him fight and wanted to get him into his NAPLIS school, which he wanted to build up the boxing reputation of this school. You know, this is how these stories go. This story is just as trite and as common of a storyline as you'd ever want to find. Just like makes me kind of think of that movie with Frank Sinatra. What was that? It was from a novel about the army, where they, you know, these sergeants want to get some good boxers because they have this, you know, their own egotistical, they want to succeed. They want their group to have the best boxers, and they box between one another and so on. And then this guy is so sadistic, and that's how they portray so many of these Nazis, is just plain sadistic. But anyway, this Friedrich, he wants to go to this school, and he also wants to box. So he leaves home. His father doesn't want him to go, but he just runs away and goes and joins and goes to this school. Now, I didn't see any more of it, but it says in this stupid movie review that in the Napola, Friedrich is forced to fight until his opponents are rendered unconscious, and he's being trained to become a merciless killer. Huh. Oh, boy. Then it says that there's the school, there's the struggle to survive the sadistic military discipline and debased ideology that goes on there. You know, this is what this movie is showing. This is this movie. And it says any sign of independent thought or humanity is eradicated like some lethal contagion. So, you know, nobody can have an independent thought. That's the typical stereotype of the Nazis and what they, you know, what they want to bring about in their members. And then the story goes on in this huge, same old trite way that he befriends this young boy, I mean, another boy there, who happens to be the son of a local governor connected to the Napola. And this man is a kind of a sadistic, tough guy named Stein. And this son, he despises his weak son. He thinks he's weak because his son has artistic aspirations and is sensitive. Now, this is so corny and unoriginal, but it's also incorrect, because you don't get the Napola. This whole system was a system of meritocracy. It's based on merit. And this governor was not going to get his son in there if he wasn't up to it, you know, if he wasn't a good candidate for this school. But they create these fake stories. And so this governor gets, you know, has his son there, and he wants his son to toughen up. So he likes this Friedrich, and he says this corny thing to him. He says to Friedrich at their first meeting, a couple more like you on the Eastern Front, and we could wrap things up. How stupid. You know, he thinks this Friedrich is a real man, a real tough guy, and so, you know, strong. And we've had few more like that on the Eastern Front, we'd wrap that up real quick. It says that he encourages this fighter, Friedrich, to decimate his own son. He wants him to decimate his own son, maybe to make his son tougher or something. And that the son, it's the story becomes about this man and his son, and he says that this event happened where the institute's students, the school students, are sent to slaughter a group of escaped Russian POWs who proved to be unarmed and as young as their killers. So here we have a scene where these Napola students are told they have to go and slaughter, I don't know how, but slaughter a group of escaped Russian POWs who, when they go to fight to see them, are unarmed and the same age as they are, but I guess they do it. And, you know, nothing like this would have ever happened either. Never. And then this boy Albrecht, the governor's son, is stricken with guilt and horror, and he publicly denounces the murders. They call them murders. And then this reviewer says, lyrically composed, this scene disturbs in the extreme as the film shifts gears, allowing for a deeply psychological moment. And says the impact of this event on Friedrich, this is the boxer student, and of course this event never happened, it's total fiction, but they say in their, you know, the way movies are, the impact of this event on Friedrich leads to a rebellion, his loss of naivete and political illusions. Of course, all people who ever believed in National Socialism were naive and had illusions, because it was never, you know, they didn't see how terrible it was. And then it says that Gansel, the writer and director of the film, visually links Friedrich's active defiance against, I guess, the Nazi system to the hungry for blood faces of the governor and his Napola cronies in the audience of the film's final boxing match. Huh. You can just imagine that. Here we have this bad film. There's a final boxing match, and Friedrich has his opportunity to do something, probably lose to his opponent when this man and his Napola cronies are there, you know, watching the match and all, and they're hungry for blood. Expecting him to kill his opponent, and he probably doesn't do it, but this is supposed to be so great. And you can just see the people watching the film cheering and yelling and, you know, being fooled by the whole thing. And then, Gansel's film is called Serious and Honest. Boy, there's nothing honest in this. And you can't take it seriously. But I mean, you know, this is the thing that's unfortunate is that this is about all you're going to see in the mass media anywhere, even on the internet, about these schools. This is what you're going to find. And it says another thing in this film. This is too much. There's a character named Siegfried, one of the students, who is a chronic bedwetter, who is persecuted beyond endurance, and later is proclaimed a hero for the manner in which he carried out his suicide. So now they've got this character who has such a terrible time at this Napola school that he commits suicide, and that's the only thing that they praise him for, is that he did a good job of committing suicide. That's the way this school is portrayed. And in the first place, if you are a chronic bedwetter, you would never be, would never be admitted into the school. Or if they found that out after you were admitted, they would never keep you there. They didn't have problem people like that there. They had people who could handle it all and had the right attitude about it. They didn't have these problem people. That's where this story is not serious and it's not honest at all. And then it says that Albrecht, that's the son of the guy, the sensitive artistic son, whom Gansel describes in an interview with Salon. And you know, Salon is that website and internet magazine that's so left-wing and anti-white. It's as left-wing and anti-white as you can get. And he describes to the interview with the Salon people in a Salon article that Albrecht was seen as the embodiment of the 19th century heritage of German philosophy and poetry. And he pits his cultural proclivities against Nazi brutishness. So, you know, this is another thing that they always do. They love to do. They like to say, oh, here you had Germany of the great philosophers and poets of Germany and the great cultural history of Germany, which the Jews basically want to take, you know, own for themselves as much as possible. And then they like to compare that against the National Socialist regime and say that National Socialist regime just was the opposite of the real German tradition. So how did Nazism ever come about in that country? Well, the Nazis were very cultural. Of course, Adolf Hitler is one of the most cultured appreciators of art, and he really knew what he was appreciating too. that Germany has produced, probably. I mean, and they had a wonderful, they continued the German culture, all through that regime. So, but this is something they can't stand to say. And so they try to portray it as very different. And people don't know. So most people go right along with that. Then this socialist website had to add, after that, this line: the physical Friedrich draws great courage. Friedrich is a boxer student. Draws great courage from his disciplined working class background. So they're going to praise that he's a good guy because he has his working class background. Oh. Don't you just love these socialists? In the film's production notes, they write, we discover that Gansel learned about the Napolis, yeah, here it is, from his grandfather's accounts and those of other former students. So this is a lie. He didn't learn that kind of thing from his grandfather's accounts, because that kind of thing didn't go on. So I don't know what he learned, but he's saying that his grandfather was a Napolis student, and then he's talked to other former students and gotten all these stories, and that's how he learned about what they were like, what it was like. Yeah, sure. So going on, they talk, they bring up that there was a former head of the Deutsche Bank was a man who had been a student at an Adolf Hitler school, which are different. The Adolf Hitler schools were National Socialist Party. They were sponsored and taken care of by the National Socialist Party, and they had some. They were very good schools too, there was two different kinds of organizations there, and the Napolis schools actually had the highest status for being the toughest, and the students having to be the most elite of all. But the Adolf Hitler schools were, I suppose, in a sense, training party people to keep the party going. And Napolis schools were training Germans, members of the Reich, to keep the Reich going, to be ministers and all kinds of positions that they would fall into. And so somehow they want to make out that because this former head of the Deutsche Bank was a student at the Adolf Hitler school, at an Adolf Hitler school, that the Nazis are the international bankers. That's basically what they're getting at here. You know, the international bankers are former Nazis. Yeah. So the Napolis only had about 15,000 boys in their history. That's not a lot, and a much smaller number of girls. As I said, there were 40 of these institutions by the end of the war. And it says about it a little bit of information, I think, from somewhere else, that next to drills, military discipline, and physical training, the school's main focus was to pass on Nazi ideology. Well, the school's focus was to educate these kids in the way with the education they would receive in a regular high school, plus Nazi ideology and lots of physical training. They did every kind of sport. You know, they were doing spear throwing. They did a lot of swimming. They spent a lot of hours. Their days were very much set out for them, scheduled. And they had to get up at, I think Leopold said 5:45 in the morning. And they had to go for a run. They lined up for some kind of, roll call thing. And then they went for a run through the woods or the fields before breakfast. And he said he didn't like that very much, but he said it did clear out the cobwebs. I guess you get used to it, but he didn't like getting up that early. That was too early for him, but that's what he had to do. And they had school, they had this, they had that, they had lots of physical time for physical education and so on, and sports. And they also had a time when they were to be comradeship time, camaraderie. And that was a couple of hours every day where they just were to be associate with one another on an easy basis and, you know, be things like that. So it was very highly scheduled. But, you know, when you talk about passing on Nazi ideology, what is wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. If you're living in a Nazi state, any kind of state you live in, you're going to be getting the ideology of that state, particularly if you're in this type of a elite school for future leaders of the state. What else are you going to get? That's what you're going to get. They just want to make out that Nazi ideology is somehow bad, whereas other ideologies are okay. And the motto of the Annapolis student was, quote, to be more than what seems to be. I think that's actually pretty good. And they do mention here that the American military's former recruitment slogan was, be all you can be. So it's similar to that, only not quite the same. To be more than what seems to be, I would think, I take that as, to seem to be, you know, somebody, you know, just not just a regular person, but, you know, a decent, ordinary person that people are approachable or people can, you know, are not afraid of. But you, as an Napola graduate, you are more than that because you have been given a higher level of training. More is expected of you. You know, a lot is expected of you, but it's not something that should be showing on the surface all the time where you're, you know, strutting around as somebody better than others. Although these people are all had, important positions. But, you know, the war changed everything. So they were all in the war. They were all, you know, they were all fighting. They're all soldiers of one kind or another after they graduated. And I'm not sure at this point yet if Leopold graduated before he started his, you know, seriously got inducted into the Luftwaffe. I'm not sure what that, you know, how that worked out, but we'll eventually find out when we get it all translated. Now, that's all I want to say about that. There's something. Leading parties. Okay, now this socialistic website is still writing about this. And here's what they end up with in this movie review. They say, above all, attention would have to be paid to the defeat of the German working class resulting from the catastrophic, when they say attention should have to be paid, they mean, they say that this, okay, they say this film is good, but it could be better, and it doesn't break any new ground, and a more profound view, now this is the, you know, the communists, a more profound view of Hitler's rise would not blame the German population for simply accommodating itself to monsters, but would probe the objective historical background to the triumph of fascism in 1933. So what they're concerned with is how did fascism ever rise up and triumph in 1933? They don't like that, and they don't like these new parties. They, you know, wouldn't like these new parties either, and they don't want them to triumph either. So they say, above all, attention would have to be paid to the defeat of the German working class, resulting from the catastrophic policies of its two leading parties, the SPD and the Communist Party. You know, they consider that when Hitler came to power, that was a defeat of the German working class. And they say that that it's because the two leading parties, the Social Democrats and the Communist Party, which was a leading party, that's the party that the National Social NSDAP defeated basically in the elections and got so many members in the legislature, and the communists lost out. So this is something that this worldwide socialist web doesn't like, and they are looking for the reasons, and they say that the socialist aspirations of the German working class had been expressing it themselves for decades, and these aspirations were shamefully betrayed and resulted, I don't know by who betrayed it, these parties, I guess, the SPD and the Communist parties, somehow failed, and the NSDAP defeated them, and this could only come about by betrayal, they say, and which resulted in a demoralized and atomized population, which was susceptible to be deluded and intimidated. Now, see what rubbish this is? The German population under the National Socialists and under Hitler were not demoralized and atomized. They were energized. They were enthusiastic. They had found a new purpose. They were united. All of this, it's not, these people put this, they just change history. They are the people who revise history however they want to make it in order to fit their own ideology. So it's just, this whole thing is not at all the reality of it. And then it goes on to say that Before the Fall, the movie, the Gansel's movie Before the Fall, leaves its mark along with other unflinching and honest recent films. An unflinching and honest film about German fascism, such as last year's Downfall and Roman Polanski's The Pianist. So, you know, they love this film because it shows German fascism is not in any way the way it really was and is, and they also liked Downfall, that horrible thing that I can't look at that either, where they have this ugly actor playing Adolf Hitler and show them all, even probably, I don't know, I didn't watch all this Before the Fall, but I might eventually sometime watch it, I don't know. But then they also mentioned Roman Polanski's The Pianist. I do remember, I did see that a long time ago, but Roman Polanski's a pedophile. Do they care about that? No. Do they care about any of these things? No. No, and yet they want to, you know, attack National Socialists. Well, in the last minutes here, let's see, I guess I didn't have any, I never had any callers. I didn't fail to see them. They're not there. Let me check my email. And then I will conclude the last few minutes here of the program with trying to tie this together with the kind of state. I think, you know, I know a lot of people say, well, we don't want to go back to Hitler and, you know, that's no answer. And we're not going to become like the Nazis again. And that's all in the past and so on. Well, fine, but you don't have to call it that. But that's the kind of program that is going to do the most for the white race. There's no question about it for me. And that's what these parties, the Golden Dawn, the Jobbik, and the Svoboda, all are of that same mind. It's pretty clear to me that they are, that is what they think would be the kind of state that they can keep, that they can make to be their own state, and I think the greatest strength for Europe and if we can somehow bring it to other places, in the world is that I was just looking at something and I lost my train of thought here. Is that the closer you come in to to the tighter connection between peoples, the stronger you're going to be. And the further out you go in your connection between peoples, the less strength you're going to have. It's nice to think that we could have a huge, white worldwide movement, European white or whatever you want to call it, all around the world. We're all going to join together and we're all going to work together and therefore have this solidarity. Well, we do have solidarity, but that is not the way to go about it. I think it has to, as I've tried to point out in this program, it has to be done on the small, more localized level, and in order to be effective and in order to have any real power to keep out the invaders and to keep out parasites and to keep out, of course, to keep out the Jews. And again, this idea of Israel being an ethno-nationalist nation, a state, is a very good one, I think, to point out. I think there's a lot of very good arguments for us that we should be using that we're not using because of a misunderstanding that people have about what we should be trying to do. So I will leave it at that. Let's see. Oh, I've still got a little time. Okay, I'm going to look at this at these Annapolis schools and tell you that the first one was founded on May 1st, 1933 in Plauen, and that was northern Germany, way up there in the north. And then the next one was in Potsdam in the Brandenburg state on May 26, 1933. Then on July 15, 1933, the one at Koslin was founded. That's the one that Leopold went to. That's in Pomerania. And then in Berlin, and Berlin Spandau was founded on January 30, 1934. And from then on, 1934, 1935, 1936, and 1938, and then two in 1903 and 1939, and then 1940. I don't know, they kept adding. So this is something that I would hope that we could eventually have more information about, as there's not enough information about these schools. So thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager signing off for the Heretics Hour on the White Network. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.